Today on Against the Grain, Santiago, the capital of Chile, was a hotbed of radical non-sectarian organizing in the 1920s when a repressive backlash led to the death of poet José Domingo Gómez Rojas. I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Raymond Crabe joins me to discuss the story of anarchists and communists, students and workers, radicals and reactionaries, the pursuing and the pursued, whose politics still echo down to our times. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. If you were to think about Chile and repression, your mind would probably jump immediately to the 1973 U.S.-backed coup that overthrew the government of socialist Salvador Allende, bringing to power the dictator Augusto Pinochet. But Chile's history of dissent and repression go back much further and include a pivotal episode in the early 1920s when radical students and workers were accused of subversion, which crucially influenced young leftists, including Allende and the poet Pablo Neruda, as well as figures on the right, who were to play key roles in Chile later in the 20th century. With a light touch and elegant prose, anarchist historian Raymond Crabe has told the story of the so-called prosecution of subversives, exploring the radicals in question and their counterparts in the elite, and bringing to life the world and city in which they lived. Ray Crabe teaches history at Cornell University, and the book is titled The Cry of the Renegade, Politics and Poetry in Interwar Chile, and it's published by Oxford University Press. He's also the author of Cartographic Mexico, and I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that I have a connection to PM Press, which published Ray Crabe's co-edited book, No Gods, No Masters, No Peripheries. Ray, I wonder if you could begin the discussion by talking about the place where this story of radicalism and repression unfolds. Obviously, the setting is Chile, but more specifically, it takes place in the capital city of Santiago with this particular geography and social stratifications.
We're looking at the early 20th century in Santiago, the capital of Chile. Santiago is a very, it's the hub of life in Chile in many respects. By the end of the 19th century, it's a city that's grown exponentially in the late 19th century with the discovery of nitrates in the north, with a kind of consolidation of a governing bureaucracy, and life becomes actually quite centralized in Santiago by certainly by the 1890s, early 1900s. It's a city that is undergoing enormous change. And I do focus very closely on the city of Santiago. This is a book that's really about the urban space and world of Santiago. It's not necessarily a history of Chile. So one of the things I lay out in the introduction is that it's not a history of Chile, but it is a Chilean history. It would look very different if it took place someplace else, but it's not a history of all of Chile, and I tend to not cover things that happen in other parts of the country at the time. But in Santiago, this is a place that's highly centralized. It's growing very quickly. You're having huge public works projects undertaken. There's a large out-migration at various points in time from the countryside, from nitrate mines in the north that are closing down because of the recession during World War I and a little bit after. And so there's enormous dynamism in the city. It's also a city where traditionally the very well-to-do, the Chilean aristocracy, lived right in the center of town, and this is quite typical for cities in much of Latin America. And they hadn't really started to sort of decamp and move out into surrounding areas or building up the suburbs that are now so fundamental to Santiago. So they're still living downtown, and they're watching an enormous transformation take place around them. There's electrified trams. The lights are converting from paraffin to electric. You have cars making their way finally into the city. Indian motorcycles, right? The company Indian. So you have a lot of changes taking place. And one of the things that this does is allows people to move across the city more affordably, more quickly, they can expand their work opportunities, they can move around the city and so forth. And so there's a kind of, I don't want to say a crisis, but there is a kind of moment in the 19-teens in which increasingly the Chilean aristocracy and well-to-do, who traditionally really own and occupy the downtown portions of the city, are starting to feel like it's not theirs anymore. And there are conflicts around things like parks and public space and so forth. And then it's a period of economic flux as well, the early 20th century. There's booms and busts, as there were in many parts of the globe, in terms of capitalist economies more generally. Chile is a place that's quite dependent on income from the nitrate mines. Nitrate is being purchased for armaments during World War I. It's also being purchased as a form of fertilizer, enormously important. First, you have guano off the coast of Peru that's very important in the nitrate and agricultural revolution in Europe and elsewhere. And then you have nitrates from the north of Chile as well. And so there's economically, there's a lot of fluidity and flux and sort of boom and bust. And so it's a period that's very fluid, unstable. There's a lot sort of changing. You have the growth of a kind of, for lack of a better word, a middle class. It's not the best term, but you have the growth of university students, bureaucrats, journalists, lawyers. These are people who are much closer to the working class in terms of their financial precarity, in terms of where they live in the city. But they do have something of a kind of stability that is often missing for both working class people and the growing so-called lumpen proletariat. So it's a period that's really dynamic and interesting.
Well, you just mentioned the category of the middle class, which, as you say, is a complicated one. And Chile has historically had a sort of self-image of itself as being more middle class, more democratic, more European than the rest of Latin America. To what degree was that notion rooted in anything to do with the political economy of Chile? And to what degree was that a self-deception?
I'm not sure it's a self-deception, but I'm also not sure how much truth one would want to ascribe to it. I mean, certainly the taking of the northern provinces, portions that belong to Bolivia and belong to Peru, so areas in the far north of Chile, where subsequently there were enormous discoveries of nitrates and other minerals, it transformed Chile's economy. It created an incredible proletariat of workers in the north, an expansion north, and then subsequently an expansion into the south, places in the far south of Chile that had long, to call them Chilean, had been just basically a kind of fiction, really. And so there was a kind of growth there and a boom there. There was a strong connection with England. There's a strong connection with Ireland, with parts of Europe. There's German immigration and so forth. But there's also a lot that one could critique as well. One of the things that I try to point toward in the book, and one of the reasons that I focus on the persecution of people who are deemed subversive in the early 19-teens and 1920s, is because there is this very strong overemphasis to some degree on the coup in 1973. And the long story has been that Chile is this kind of stable democracy in a continent that is plagued with coups d'etat and so on and so forth. And I wanted to point towards the fact that there were multiple earlier moments of radical illiberalism, persecution, violence, class conflict, and so forth, and to sort of move out of the shadow a little bit of the Allende era, and then subsequently the military dictatorship of Pinochet and the junta. So, you know, I think there's a way in which, to some degree, these notions of Chilean exceptionalism are akin to notions of U.S. exceptionalism. They're undergirded by a kind of nationalist or patriotic mythology. They have certain grains of foundation in them, but that's not they're not truths about exceptionalism. They're grains of fact that have to do with the ways in which economies developed over the course of time, the kind of class structures that developed over the course of time, and many of them built on imperial expansion, frankly. And in this case, Chile's expansion north, the appropriation of land from Peru and Bolivia, and south, and the appropriation of land from the Mapuche and Pehuenche people.
What did radical politics in Chile and in Santiago in particular look like in the teens and the early 1920s?
So I'm interested in this book in particular, I'm interested in what I've ended up calling the capacious left, a kind of plural left. The strong historiographical tradition has been to emphasize the importance and power of the Communist Party, and to some degree the Socialist Party as well, the PULS, the Socialist Workers' Party, that would, by the early 1920s, become the Communist Party in 1922. And there's understandable reasons why that's the case, in particular because of the importance of the Communist Party in the mines, in particular, both in the north, but then also in the coal zones in the south and elsewhere. But I was really interested in trying to think about the kind of broader political spectrum of the 19-teens, and in particular the importance of forms of anarchist political organizing. The anarchists were enormously important in the early 20th century in many parts of the globe. I mean, this is something that someone who's not a very sympathetic commentator, and that is Eric Hobsbawm. I mean, Eric Hobsbawm points out in one of his works that the most important leftist movement of the early 20th century around the globe was, in fact, the anarchist movement. Right? And you also see this in more recent works, the collection by Stephen Hirsch and Lucien van der Walt on the colonial and post-colonial world and anarchism. You see this in Benedict Anderson's work on Indonesia and Spain and France and the Philippines and Cuba. And so I wanted to recapture some of that. And what was quite interesting to me was, over the process of doing my research, was the degree to which many people who were members of the Socialist Workers' Party also identified as anarchist, or they read profusely. I mean, they read anarchist writers, and they debated and talked, and they argued about what anarchism looked like. They had many of these people had a kind of sense of a shared kind of politics that first and foremost was about a common enemy, and that common enemy being the old aristocracy, the new bourgeoisie, and the state, upon which both of those categories of people relied for their power. So I was interested in getting out of kind of purist and categorical narratives and trying to think and look at the ways in which people were to some degree sort of everyday anarchists, organizing in different kinds of ways, mobilizing, crossing different kinds of boundaries that we usually sometimes retrospectively put on people. And the person that I write about at the beginning of the book, Casimiro Barrios, is my favorite example of this. I mean, even within the groups on the left, he was uncategorizable. You know, you had some people in the Socialist Workers' Party who wanted to expel him because they said he was an anarchist and he was going to get everybody in trouble. And you had other members of the Socialist Workers' Party saying Casimiro Barrios had done more than anybody to sort of organize the left in Santiago and to get people to turn out into the streets, the demonstrations, to knock on doors and organize and to fight for workers' rights around labor law and things like this. And then you have others just saying, I don't know what he is, but he's a free thinker. You have Barrios himself describing himself in a variety of different kinds of ways. And he's a member of the Socialist Workers' Party, but he also identifies as anarchist. And then by 1925, he's going to name his son Santiago Lenin Barrios and become a member of the Communist Party. And he'll be expelled in 1927 for being a communist. He'd been previously expelled in 1920 for being an anarchist. And so that it's that kind of fluidity, that kind of sense in which what's less important in some ways are these kinds of categories that are applied to people, and what's more important is the ways in which they organized and struggled and the kind of work that they did and the kinds of ways in which they formulated and theorized the things that they did. So politics at that time, I mean, that's essentially for Santiago in particular. I mean, things like the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, is very strong in the port of Valparaiso, as is traditionally been the case with the IWW. But they were also very strong in Santiago. Increasingly, they found a lot of support in the building trades, construction, painters, carpenters. They found support amongst the bakers. They found allies, not necessarily members, but they found allies amongst the shoe workers. Manufacturing becomes enormously important in Santiago by the end of the 19-teens, and in fact eclipses the nitrate mines for a period of time as well, beginning in 1918 and 1919. So the IWW is very politically active and will be throughout the 1920s in Santiago and elsewhere in Chile and along the Pacific and Atlantic seaboard.
Historian Raymond Crabb is my guest. We're discussing his book, The Cry of the Renegade, Politics and Poetry in Interwar Chile. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So I wanted to ask you a bit more about the notion that you explore in The Cry of the Renegade of this capacious left, as you put it, where the demarcations between anarchists and communists and socialists are not hard and fast, that even for some people, the way they might self-identify shifts over time or even within the space of a moment. To what degree was that particular to a limited number of years leading up to the mid-1920s? You do talk about in your book, and we haven't yet gotten into the story, which we will in a moment, that unfolds. But one thing that was to divide the left within space of a few years around the world was the Russian Revolution, which was in its early days, was to divide anarchists and communists. So are we talking about something that was just really specific to the moment that you're writing about? Or would you say that that kind of capacious left continued in Chile beyond this period?
I'm a little bit of an optimist. I think in certain ways it did persist. I mean, there's clearly, over the course of time, absolutely, there's a clear recognition that develops, and certainly by 1921 and 1922, that what many had thought the future might look like in the midst of and in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution wasn't coming to pass, right? So the suppression of Makhno, the suppression of the Kronstadt uprising. I mean, these are these moments that people are debating intensely, and of course the Communist Party is founded in 1922 in Chile and becomes an important organizing structure and political structure at that point in time. I mean, some of the people that I write about, self-identified anarchists, they were pretty dubious from the outset, right? Juan Gandulfo, someone who's very central to the story and an incredible figure. Juan Gandulfo, right off the bat, kind of had this very prescient vision of a new kind of state structure arising amongst the Bolsheviks. But the vast majority of people who identified as anarchists in Chile in 1917, 1918, 1919, really saw the Bolshevik Revolution as the kind of dawning of a so-called anarcho-communist future, is the way that they would frequently put it. Despite the kinds of things that unfolded, despite the skepticism, despite the disappointments, many of them sustained that belief well into the 1920s.
Well, let's dive into the story itself. What were the events that led up to the death of poet José Domingo Gómez Rojas?
Yeah, so the book is essentially, what it tries to do is narrate the 4 months of July through October of 1920. So that's winter time in Chile, and it's a pretty brutal winter, not just in terms of weather. There's heavy snowfall, and it's quite cold, but also in terms of the repression that people are experiencing. And what I look at are a group of people who are friends, comrades, in certain instances, persecutors of Gómez Rojas and his circle. And so I pick up the story on the 19th of July in 1920 when Chile's parliamentarians, aristocrats have begun to mobilize troops on the border with Peru under the suggestion, and it's a somewhat instrumentalized suggestion, a suspect suggestion, that Peru is going to invade northern Chile to kind of recuperate some of the territory that it had lost in the War of the Pacific back in 1879, 1880. There's a strong critique that is made against that mobilization, and not least of all by young radical university students. The university is changing dramatically in the 19-teens. The university goes from sort of 19th century model in which the university was largely a place where children of the privileged would go and be trained so that they could then step into the shoes of the ruling class and administer the state, so to speak. That really begins to change in the early 20th century. And in 1906, there's the founding of the Chilean Student Federation, the FETCH, by its Spanish acronym. And this is a really important moment in which students begin to emerge as political subjects, in which they begin to demand greater university autonomy, demand a certain kind of voice related to faculty, related to the things that are being taught. The university itself is expanding. It's beginning to teach other subjects of different kinds. And so you get more and more kind of schools within the university developing. There's another university. So I'm talking about the University of Chile here, but then the Catholic University is created, a private university, more conservative at the time, certainly. So the university itself is changing, and by the 19-teens, its doors are welcoming in more and more students from, not just from Santiago and from Valparaiso, but from the provinces and from less well-to-do backgrounds. And so the people who will become quite prominent in Chilean letters and politics over the course of the 20th century, this is their story, including someone like Salvador Allende, including someone like Juan Gandulfo and his brother Pedro, but also including José Domingo Gómez Rojas himself, this poet. And so many of them are coming from the provinces. Many of them are coming from modest backgrounds. They live in boarding houses and at what are called pensiones in sort of working districts in Santiago. And this affects their politics in different kinds of ways. So the students in the FETCH and the Student Federation launch a critique of this mobilization. And embedded in that critique is a broader critique of Chilean society and Chilean political economy more generally. And there's an enormous response. And it's a response that is hyper-patriotic. It's a response that basically suggests the students are completely speaking out of place. And I have a long moment in the book where I talk about the ways in which speaking out of turn, being so-called insolent, is fundamental to the repression that people experience. And that sounds like I'm making light of politics, but I'm not. I mean, I think there's a real argument to be made about the politics of insolence. So this is what the students are doing. They're critiquing and they're allying with working people. And because working people and students have slowly started to build popular universities, night schools, free medical clinics, a range of kind of social interventions and relationships that are developed. And the economy is in tough shape at the same time. And so there's a kind of crisis within the ruling class, and the response is to pursue vehemently students in the University Federation, the Student University Federation, who are seen to be subversive, anti-patriotic, potentially allied with Peruvian students. And then there's also an effort to, at the same time, to go after really strongly the IWW and people who are deemed to be anarchist. And all of them are captured under this term subversive. And so it begins in July 19 of 1920. This is the kind of first moment in which a large group of very conservative students and military personnel will attack the offices of the Student Federation in downtown Santiago, right in the city center. There'll be a subsequent attack on the 21st of July. A lot of people will, at the end of July, be rounded up by the police and they'll be detained for extensive periods of time. And one of those people was Jose Domingo Gomez Rojas, a poet, university student in the School of Pedagogy, a clerk, actually, a small-time bureaucrat clerk in one of the ministries in the city. I mean, he was many things, and also the secretary for the IWW at the time as well. And he's one of many who will be rounded up. There's hundreds of people rounded up and detained. They're denied bail. And he eventually will be put into isolation, stripped of his clothes, denied writing implements, denied books, put on a diet of bread and water only. He'll be shackled. And his mental state deteriorates quite substantially. He's moved to an asylum at the end of September of 1920, and he dies. So the book takes you from basically July 19th of 1920 through the death of Gomez Rojas on September 29th of 1920, and then it tries to move back in time at each chapter to give you a sense of context and the kind of historical processes that were at work in Santiago.
Did the ruling class feel genuinely threatened by this student movement and its link to the workers' movement, or was this seen more as an opportunity to preemptively repress incipient movements?
I think it was both. It was clearly, in some sense, a very opportunistic way to come down hard on labor. I think not just the IWW, although certainly the IWW became the target of a lot of wrath. There was a real effort to wipe the IWW out, both in Valparaiso and in Santiago, and in the south as well, in places like the Magallanes. So it was certainly an opportunistic moment for assaulting labor at a pretty difficult time economically and politically. But I think there was also a sense of, I mean, how much you'd want to call it a threat is unclear to me. But there's clearly a sense in which the world is shifting underneath the feet of people who had traditionally thought the world, public space, politics belonged to them. And I stress this notion of insolence quite strongly in the book, because there really is, you read the debates on the floor of the Congress, you read the kinds of responses that people would articulate in the press around the student movement and things like this. And there's a very, very strong sense of people speaking out of turn, people finding voice collectively and individually and weighing in on common matters and political matters that shouldn't be, in theory, in their purview, right? They should be quiet and do their work. Right? I remember when I was a graduate student at Yale, anyways, this is a brief aside, so I apologize for this. But I remember, the workers at Yale were striking, graduate students were seeking unionization, and there was a demonstration on campus, and a student, Corey Robin, wrote a really wonderful op-ed about this in the New York Times right when it happened in the late 90s. Some student in the dorm sort of leaned out the window and said, you know, be quiet and get back to work. Right? And that's a little bit what it was. It's that kind of just powerful class politics that says, I can tell you what to do, and this is your place, and this is what you need to do. And there's a real sense amongst the Chilean ruling classes at the time that this is exactly what's happening. Even public spaces and who occupies public spaces and who can promenade around the park at particular points in time and so forth, right? These are the things that that worry them. So I think it's a mix.
I'm speaking with historian Raymond Crabe. We'll return with him in just a moment.
Amor é tudo contém. canta buñamu, oh mundo. Cham canta buñamu, panuano. Cham canta buñamu, oh mundo. Cham canta buñamu, panuano.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of The Cry of the Renegade, Politics and Poetry in Interwar Chile. That's published by Oxford University Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Its author is Raymond Crabe. He teaches history at Cornell University, and his other books include Cartographic Mexico. We're discussing the student movement and its links to the larger working class in Santiago at the beginning of the 1920s, and the repression of that movement by the elite. And one of the things that is striking in the book is both that you focus on the student movement in its many facets, but also the reminder that although we associate, whether it's Latin America or the United States, student movements with the left, of course you also have students on the right, and the reactionary students, many of them coming from the elite, play a key role in this story.
Yeah, they do. And it is important to stress. I mean, one of the things that a kind of slippery practice sometimes is to talk about university students sort of in the abstract or homogeneously. And of course, it's a very heterogeneous population. And in fact, writers at the time, university students at the time who were writing, or even sort of worker intellectuals, someone like José Santos González Vera, writing at the time, would comment just upon the kind of variety of people making up the student population generally, but also sort of participating in student politics in different kinds of ways. So it is true, the primary assailants who attacked the headquarters or the club of the Student Federation were other students, many of them from the Catholic University that had been founded a couple of decades earlier. And most of them, yes, from at least the ones who were publicly identified and outed in publications in the hopes that the prosecutor and the police would pursue them and press charges, which they did to some degree, but not really very strenuously, as you could imagine. But the ones who were identified were largely from very well-to-do families who still lived in the city center of Santiago. You did have students in the FETCH itself who distanced themselves from the Student Federation, from the FETCH, in 1917, 1918, 1919. They felt that it had taken a more combative turn. It had taken a more a turn towards sort of anarchist and anarcho-communist politics that they were unsettled by. So there's vociferous and quite intense debate within the FETCH itself, amongst students, but also amongst some faculty who in different ways had been working with students and organizing night schools and so forth, who also feel that it's gone in a political direction that they're not comfortable with. The branch of the FETCH that is associated with the School of Agronomy and another one in Valparaiso, a branch of the FETCH in Valparaiso, both publicly renounced the FETCH in the press in July of 1920 and tried to distance themselves from the FETCH in Santiago. And so, you know, there's a lot of variety and sort of back and forth there. And the assailants, right, the conservative students, primarily conservative students who participate in the assault on the FETCH, it's fascinating to trace who many of these individuals are and who they go on to be in public and political life in Chile in the 30s and 40s and 50s, just as it's very fascinating to follow some of the students, leftist students in the FETCH, and sort of where they end up later in life as well.
Your story is one, as should be apparent here, of both the pursued and the pursuing, and one player in this story of the repression of Chilean student radicals in the late teens, early 20s, is the judge José Astorquiza. Tell us about him and the role that he played in all of this.
José Ortiz is an interesting individual, and I try to learn as much about him as I possibly could. He's a reviled figure. I mention in the epilogue to the book that the great satirical magazine in Chile, a very, very good political magazine, also satirical magazine called The Clinic, had a list in 2008 that it published of Chile's top 25 conches su madres, which is a pretty intense insult. And on that list, José Astorquiza figures along with Pinochet and also somebody else that I write about, a police, the head of the detective agency, the security section, and subsequently the detective agency in Chile in the 1920s, Ventura Maturana. So José Astorquiza is quite interesting. He often appears, if he appears at all in history books, it's in relationship to Gómez Rojas. He's held kind of directly responsible for the death of Gómez Rojas. He's the prosecutor who is leading all of the efforts to round up wobblies and anarchists and students and so on and so forth. And he's really seen as the kind of, if Gómez Rojas were to be Jesus, then Astorquiza would be Pontius Pilate, maybe even Satan, who knows. But he certainly has this very one-dimensional component to him. And it's clear from my research and from the work that I did and from others' work that he clearly bears some responsibility. He subverted the law. He was small-minded. He was absolutely zealous in his willingness to take people away from their families and hold them for extended periods of time without access to bail, despite the fact that, according to the charges that had been pursued against them, they should have been allowed bail and so on and so forth. And this had a terrible impact, as you can imagine, on working people's families, on their lives more generally, and for students as well. There's a number of students who suffer mentally and physically over the course of their detainment. So he certainly is a figure that you wouldn't want to make excuses for. But I did want to try to understand him, because I do feel like the emphasis, the sort of hyper-emphasis on Astorquiza basically removes the rest of Chile's conservative, in particular, aristocracy from any kind of responsibility for what unfolded. It's hard to kind of nail this down, but there's enough suggestion that Astorquiza, in fact, was having trouble paying a mortgage that he had on a large property that he owned to the south that he seems to have inherited from his father. And it's unclear where the financial difficulties came from. But it does seem, this is circumstantial, but the strong impression I have is that, in fact, he was under some financial duress, and there may have been a kind of quid pro quo that the loans wouldn't be called in on him in return for taking a certain kind of position vis-a-vis the students and leftists at the time period. And so, I wanted to kind of coax him open a little bit and see that, in fact, he's both an agent in the story, but he's also somebody who's a little bit of an unfree, even as he's jailing other people, he's a little bit unfree himself. He's part of a broader structure. There's a wonderful quote from Raymond Williams in The Country and the City about not focusing too much on the bailiff or the surveyor or the judge when you explore the history of expropriation that was the enclosure movement. There's a broader structural issue at work there, and I think that's what I wanted to accomplish with Astorquiza as well. It's important to hold him accountable, and at the same time, it's also important to recognize that he was part of a world as well that was completely involved in this and engaged with him and had certain things that they wanted to see happen. And so I follow the judge, Astorquiza, all the way through the book. And it's a terrible story for him in the end, in part because his wife is a very, very devout Catholic. And I discussed this in the epilogue. His wife goes to the home, this very, very sort of modest home in a working class district in Santiago. She goes to the home of José Domingo Gómez Rojas's mother. And the mother doesn't know who this person is. And so Astorquiza's wife gets out of the car. She's brought her daughter with her. and wants to convey her sorrow at the death of her son, of Gomez Rojas. And of course, the mother and tells her, you know, you just have to accept these things, be a good Catholic, and so on and so forth. And Gomez Rojas's mother just absolutely, as you could imagine, responds vehemently that she will never forgive the structure that did this to her son. She will never forgive the judge, Astorquiza, and sort of curses him to hell. And Astorquiza's wife, of course, as you can imagine, is completely fraught or distraught by this. And she ends up, not much later, she ends up in an asylum on the coast of Chile and dies shortly thereafter. And it's a very, it's a remarkable scene of anguish that was narrated by Gomez Rojas's mother to an interviewer in the late 1920s. It's a really remarkable moment.
I'm speaking with Raymond Crabb about his book, The Cry of the Renegade, Politics and Poetry in Interwar Chile. He teaches history at Cornell University, and I'm Sasha Lilly. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You mentioned a moment ago that Raymond Williams had advised not focusing on the bailiff, the villain, in effect, when looking at the larger picture of the history of expropriation. And similarly, in focusing on different individuals on the left, you seem to be also striving to take them out of the position of individual martyrdom, in particular, José Domingo Gómez Rojas, the poet who dies, drawing some larger conclusions about the politics of the time, the kind of world that he inhabited along with others. You've mentioned Juan Gondulfo, Julio Valiente was another, different people who were radicals, who were engaged in a particular kind of radical politics that eschewed sectarianism, where people subscribed to a kind of widely embracing radicalism, and also took a particular kind of approach, it seems, in their politics, which in contrast perhaps to the ways that anarchism in particular is written about historically and in the present, bomb throwers and so on, that they subscribe to a particular kind of practice. Is that fair to say, and how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think that's very fair to say. I mean, one of the things I wanted to, I mean, for anybody who's worked on the history of anarchism or is involved in anarchist movements, I mean, this is not news, obviously, but I think there's still amongst the general public a kind of sense of anarchism as people that are held together by a commitment to violence rather than solidarity, that tend to be not organized when in fact they're very well organized, bomb throwers rather than organizers, sometimes middle class, you know, bourgeois kids who are suffering from ennui and so they need something else to do. I mean, there's a lot of stereotypes that continue to get trotted out about anarchist politics, and I wanted to really spend some time and pay attention to the patient, long-term organizing efforts that people who identified as anarchists engaged in, and they were committed theoretically, intellectually, politically, socially, and they had a long-term vision. It wasn't utopic. It was real to them, and they really worked hard. They did a lot of the really tough grunt work that is not romantic, that is not sort of spontaneous and things like this. It's the long work of organizing people. It's the long work of knocking on doors and getting people to come out and participate in a demonstration, or learning labor law and constantly lobbying and advocating for working people, of understanding the ways in which the economy is organized locally. I mean, I talk about some of these characters as sedentary anarchists, and by this I'm trying to get at precisely this, that what made many of these people a threat was not just that they were anarchist in the politics that they ascribe to, but the fact that they were sedentary. They were there in Santiago long term. They knew who the bad employers were. They knew who the employers were who didn't follow labor laws properly, who paid their workers in alcohol or scrip rather than wages. All of these kinds of things, this real powerful sort of situated or local knowledge, this is in part what made them a threat, particularly at moments of perceived crisis on the part of the ruling class. And so I wanted to stress that and really bring that dimension of anarchist and anarcho-communist and anarcho-syndicalist and so forth politics to life in the book. And so, yeah, Casimiro Barrios, Julio Valiente, Juan Gandulfo, I mean, these are figures who are pretty remarkable in the labor they performed and their relentless effort to organize people.
Over the last decade and a half, Chile has been periodically rocked by a mass radical student movement. And I wondered if you saw any connection between the politics of the late teens and 30s of this radical student movement and the politics of the recent past.
Yeah, I don't want to make easy comparisons, but I think actually there's a strong comparison and also a little bit of a continuity that I think is there as well. In 2013, the presidency of the FETCH, right, which is still around, the University Federation, Student University Federation, passed to Melissa Sepúlveda, and she's a self-ascribed, self-identified anarchist, very important. The anarchist movement more generally is extremely important in student politics in contemporary Chile. The interesting thing is, there's been a series of uprisings in 2001, the what's called the backpack uprising, the mochilazo. There's the pingüinos, penguin uprising of 2006. Penguin refers to the uniforms that children wore to school, to middle and high school, that looked a little bit like a penguin. And then the uprisings in 2011. And the interesting thing is, in 2011, the leader of the FETCH was Camila Vallejo. She's now in Congress, member of the Communist Party. And then you saw it move from communist to anarchist with Melissa Sepúlveda. And that orientation has been sustained up to this day in the FETCH. Many of the individuals who were really at the forefront of the student insurgencies of 2011, 2012, 2013, they learned a lot of their organizing strategies. They learned their politics. They embraced a kind of anarchist orientation and politics, in part because of the ways in which they organized themselves when they were in middle and high school, right? When they occupied the grounds of their schools, and when they participated in mass demonstrations and occupations of their schools. And so it's a remarkable sort of living, breathing story of people learning their politics in the process of engaging politically. Gomez Rojas is somebody, so the FETCH has a mural that was painted recently in their main offices, and there's a wonderful image of a variety of people, very important, but of Gomez Rojas there. He was someone that was forgotten for quite some time by mainstream Chilean society, but it's quite interesting to track him out over the course of the 20th century. He was not forgotten amongst the left. Anarchists and lightermen, lancheros, you know, guys who small boats in the harbors who ferry stuff back and forth from the larger ships. They did theatrical performances. They named their theater after Gomez Rojas. They worked hard to have a third edition of Gomez Rojas's collected poems produced in the 1920s. He was remembered by the students themselves under the Popular Front government in 1940. Enrique Lin, one of the great 20th century poets in Chile, actually has a poem where he's in his notebook, he writes about Gomez Rojas, but then the poem itself actually opens up with a line that's very, very reminiscent of one of the opening lines of Gomez Rojas's great poems, which the title of the book comes from, Renegación, which I've translated as The Cry of the Renegade. So he's remembered on the left. You get up to the coup d'etat, and one of the movements that was created in the early 1980s, a kind of underground movement that was in the University of Chile and in the Catholic University, and it was a movement that developed to basically find a way to organize students to combat the intellectual and political repression of students under the dictatorship, called itself the Grupo José Domingo Gómez Rojas. And one of the founders of that movement told me that part of what they were trying to do was to rescue this tradition of student politics, and that they were attracted to Gomez Rojas. He was a literary figure, and lots of people involved in the movement in the 1980s were in literature and humanities, theater. And so they wanted to not allow this kind of history to be obliterated and to be lost. And that's now sustained in certain ways. People have really sought to try to recuperate this long tradition of student political activism, leftist activism amongst the students, and so forth. So I think there's a comparison between the teens and 20s and the contemporary era to be made. Certainly, even on a kind of economic scale, the critique by the contemporary students of neoliberal politics and profit in education and whether education is a right or a privilege, and what that says more broadly about the kind of political economy that contemporary Chile has inherited from the Pinochet era, that is very resonant with the kinds of critiques that students in the 19-teens and the 1920s were making as well, as they tried to wrestle with the meaning of the Russian Revolution, when they were looking at the kind of politics unfolding in a place like Barcelona, when they were looking within Chile itself at the nature of wealth distribution, the economy, and so forth.
I've been speaking in this hour with historian Raymond Crabe. He teaches at Cornell University, is the author of The Cry of the Renegade, Politics and Poetry in Interwar Chile. That's published by Oxford University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He is also the author of Cartographic Mexico and co-editor with Barry Maxwell of No Gods, No Masters, No Peripheries. That's published by PM Press, and in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I have a connection with PM Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.